hamster with a blunt penknife would do it quicker.
Hello, and build high for happiness, because we are here for the Ice Heart Hamster and a Blunt Penknife podcast. My name is Dan, and I'm here with our wonderful host, Joe.
Hello. I didn't realise you were going all those bits. How wonderful. Ice Heart, eh? Is that what you think this podcast is? Ice Heart.
Oh, it's one of my favourites.
We're not a yawny Ulster, then.
No. I mean, I struggle to keep up with it because you produce so much.
But no one can listen to all my a life's work. I think there's one or two that do, but they're only let out of the asylum on a Sunday.
Okay. Fair enough. But yeah.
Come on. This is all yours. You can introduce what we're doing and all that. I'll put my feet up.
Oh, yes. Right. Okay. Yeah. Forgive me, listeners. I'm new to all of this. So, yes. So we are discussing episode 2 of Paradise Towers, if you hadn't guessed from the intro. So here we go.
Shall we? We had a long preamble in episode 1. Should we just jump straight into 2?
Yeah, let's do it.
How did we end the episode? I can't even remember.
We did Fraser's question about...
Oh, no, I meant the actual episode. Chief Caretaker, isn't it?
Yes. Because he feels that the Doctor, or reckons the Doctor, is the chief not the chief architect, the great architect, and wants to kill him.
What should we do with him now, then, Chief?
This
is so quotable, this story. I'm so sorry. Okay, well, shall I count us in then? You introed.
Okay, yeah, let's do it.
In 3, 2, 1, off we go. Well, I suppose this is an appropriate time to talk about Richard Briers and his eccentric turn as the Chief Caretaker.
Yeah, I mean, until he becomes possessed, I think it's a really good performance. But I may be at a...
No, come on, tell me why.
Yeah, no, because, you know, it's... He's a guy that we've kind of worked with people like this, haven't we? You know, throughout our careers, that are jobs worths, that... they adhere to the rule book... All else, you know, everything else, you know, that goes along with their job can go to the wayside. But as long as they stick to that rule book, and I kind of like the way that he does that, because I think around about this time he was in a sitcom called Ever Degreasing Circles. I don't know.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Where he was like the chairperson of this residents association or something, wasn't it? And he was very much like that so I can see why they would go, this is a brilliant bit of casting. We've got Richard Briers in. If he can lift that character from Ever Decreasing Circles and kind of put it here as the chief caretaker, then you know, that's great. It's his decision what to do when he becomes possessed that I have issue with.
I'm going to fight you on that when it comes. And I know no one likes that version of the character, but I'll save it till we get there, because I think there's something more interesting going on there than other people. Even J&T was dragged Briers to his office with Clive Merrison and was like, you are taking the piss. Like, he really laid into him.
Yeah, because I mean, there are bits of it that I get, because fundamentally he is a reanimated corpse at that point. That's been, you know. So
how do you play that? The
kind of like, you know, like he's very stiff and in his movements and stuff. I think that's fabulous, but there's just something that just. It kind of takes you out of the story a little bit.
Well, it's embarrassing as well. Like, it's a point where you wouldn't want to be watching with anyone else, you know?
No. Yeah, you're definitely happy with the first 3 episodes.
I think it's sort of, you know, like, if this is the Panto season, you know, that would be the Panto that you go to that you're too embarrassed to watch
Yeah, you go by yourself.
Oh God, this bit here. I'm a finely tuned fighting machine, Dan.
Oh, aren't we all? looking at him, I think we are.
Oh, bless him. I do like their relationship, though, where she is sort of chiding and deriding him for destroying things all the time, and him wanting to stick with her because he's too afraid, her then finding out why he's there, his redemption story, and her sort of building a friendship with her. I like all of that.
Yes. No, I think it's a great little double act for this story. And obviously, like you say, there's a lovely redemption arc with him, because he was obviously this coward that ran away from going to war.
If we was honest,
oh, we all would.
It would be us, yeah. I think, like, you know, we wouldn't be those brave soldiers going.
No, no way.
I'll be the one hiding in the shadows going, are they gone yet? Okay, good.
Yeah.
Oh, boy, Dan, what do you think about this scene where he uses the rule book to bamboozle the caretakers?
It's brilliant. It's fantastic. It's one of those things where you go, that's McCoy's doctor, isn't it? Like,
it's crystallizing, isn't it?
Yeah. Because, you know, like you've got that in Happiness Patrol where he talks those two snipers out of killing. And even in Remembrance, he talks the Supreme Dalek to death, doesn't he? You know, and I think that's McCoy's doctor. I mean, I know he's like this, you know, we kind of get this impression of him towards the end of being this galactic chess player where he's moving the pieces into position. But he's one that uses his mind rather than his fists. He's a doctor of intelligence and reasoning rather than one that's sort of one of violence and action, I suppose.
Are you suggesting then if he talks his villains to death, he is in fact the Captain Kirk of the Doctor Who universe?
Ooh.
Kirk used to do that all the time with the robots and things, didn't he?
He did. But he also could, he wasn't afraid of, you know, getting into a scuffle, was he?
There's another pex for you. He thought he was a muscle man, but he had a bit of a tum.
Is that episode where he's walking around with his top off and he's all pissing and sweating?
Oh, my God. It's so funny. Suck it in a bit, Shatner.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, Shatner.
What's great about this scene is the Doctor's figured out how to use their sort of rule-bound ways against them.
Yeah.
So he's sort of figured out these people now. And yeah, I just think it's really, really clever. And it's funny.
Yeah. Because I think, like, what makes it funny is the deputy caretaker. Because he thinks, you know, we've got him where we want him, you know. But the Doctor just plays him.
It's the way he goes, but if we do that, and McCoy goes, I know, but it is in here.
It's in the rules, yeah. And then that bit later on where he then goes, he just gives the prisoner long enough. And he goes, oh, long enough to do what? And he goes, oh, long enough just to, you know, take your card and unlock the door. And he goes, eh, what?
Then he goes, rules are supposed to make sense. He's at the end of the scene. It's really funny. Do you know, did you watch the Behind the Sofa on the Blu-ray of this one?
I don't think I have. I've got it on the shelf. I'm really terrible. I buy it and then don't watch it.
Well, I mean, who has the time to watch all 500 hours of special features that you get? But it's of the four stories this season, because, you know, you've got Davison in there, Janet Fielding. They can be hypercritical of some of this stuff. They fucking loved all of this. They loved all these amazing character actors in these quirky roles, just clearly having a ball. And, you know, I weirdly enough, sometimes when you watch reaction videos and things like this, you get endorsement when they like something you like. And when Peter Davison and Janet Fielding are enjoying something, that's the highest endorsement you can possibly give it. But they adored this scene.
Yeah. I know, like, again, J&T is very much a Marmite kind of persona of Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yeah.
But Doctor Who just wasn't popular at this point. I mean, this was going out against Coronation Street, wasn't it, midweek? But I don't know. He managed to get such good actors in, to give the show a bit of gravitas that it wouldn't have had otherwise, all throughout the 80s, really. And then, people often then point the finger at him about stunt casting and all this sort of thing, but it was necessary. But I think a lot of those actors he got in that were stunt casting, oh, that's a great image, isn't it, with that window behind Sylvester and he's just that silhouette.
Oh, that's yeah, amazing.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Nick Mallet, but we'll get there. We'll get there.
But I think like with the like I say, there's not many of those actors that were cast because of their status that don't give a fantastic performance. But it's something that's used to kind of smash J&T over the head with.
Well, let's dispel one of those myths again then, because I don't think he puts a foot wrong with casting.
No.
I think even the ones where it's left field, like Beryl Reed, the story is more enjoyable for that performance. I think Trial of a Time Lord is basically lifted high by its incredible guest cast. And that's all J&T. I think
It
he went to a
somehow.
party, didn't he? And got Bellingham, Jason, Tony Selby, all at the same party. No, absolutely brilliant. Well, come on then. We'll talk about Clive Merrison then and why you think he's so fabulous in this.
He's brilliant from that. We've talked about, that these guys kind of live by this rule book, that they'll live by it, they'll die by it, and that's the be all and end all. But he's just, I just think that he's played quite straight, but because of that, he's very, very funny. And I just think it's a fantastic performance from him, and for me, he's one of the best things about it. I just think it's, whereas there's question marks over Richard Briers and some of his choices, I don't think I've got any of that with Clive Merrison. I think he plays that downtrodden subordinate really, really well.
It's a good double act, isn't it?
It is. And because that devotion that he's got to the chief, kind of, because he's like, "Hey, Chiefy," and all this sort of stuff, it's just, oh, I just love it.
There's one line he's got that I memorized, I can't believe it, but it's like, what is it? Report from floor 109, Chief. Two of the oldsters have gone down the standard HY2 waste disposal unit. I mean, he just says these lines in the most insane ways. It's so funny.
And they've got that kind of, both him and Bryce have got that kind of, oh yes, we're gonna do it this kind of way, that you expect train spotters and people in that kind of position to kind of talk like.
But I think that's one of the reasons we go back to what we said at the start of the commentary, why people don't like this, because it looks like they're taking the piss. I don't think they are,
No, definitely not.
but it can kind of, it's like Trist in Nightmare of Eden again,
Oh,
you're
don't
claiming
get me
superior
started.
knowledge, it's putting on a weird accent. Yeah, and
Yeah,
again, like, jump forward to 26, you just don't have none of that anymore.
no, they've dialed down the fun, haven't they? Definitely.
But did I just spot Hyacinth Bouquet's sister enter the
Yes.
fray?
Yeah. Onslow's wife.
Judy Cornwall. Oh my God, don't you love it when she's really horny in the bed? Oh, Onslow. She
And he's just not bothered, is it?
she's the nice Resi, isn't she?
Yeah, Maddie, isn't
What is it? She says, some have been worse than others. So is the idea then that she hasn't been eating people?
Yeah, I get. Yeah, I assume that's what they're trying to imply, that they're obviously there's a group of the Rezzies that have resorted to being cannibals and therefore eating Kangs, as you know, Rezzies are full of lies and full of Kangs, you know, kind
Oh, nice.
but
I'm full of Kangs. I couldn't eat another thing. I'm so sorry. I've got a yogurt for dessert. No, I'll pass. Thank you. Oh, that's such a, it is such a grim idea. I mean, I thought we did cannibals were out from season 22, you know, but it's dark, isn't it?
It is. I mean, like, we, obviously we haven't got to it, but the second time that Mel encounters them, and it's much more darker, shall we say. But it's like, you know, they're brandishing knives and posting forks as weapons and stuff. It's just like, whoa.
But they still get lines like, see if you can spot the basil. You know, like, it's insane,
humor,
the story.
Isn't it? It's that dark black humor.
And I... Again, I'm going to say it, I do think that's an issue people have with this, is that so much of this is played for laughs. And I think other people can see a version of this that is it, that is like High Rise, you know, the Ballard story, which is completely serious. I don't know. Would that be Doctor Who, though?
No, I don't think it is. Certainly not 1980s Doctor Who.
I mean, even something like Ghostlight is full of gags.
I mean, that's the thing, you know, like the cream of Scotland Yard, because he's just been turned into a soup, you know, and it's there's so many subtle gags. I think that that's the thing. They haven't necessarily dialed down the fun on the humour. They've made it more subtle and, you know,
maybe
it,
a bit more sophisticated.
Yeah, more cerebral, isn't it? You know, to
less
kind of,
obvious.
Yeah.
Like, was it? I wanted to see how it worked, so I dismantled it with the maid's arm. What the hell?
Oh, I love Mary Flood.
Oh, dear. But this is witty, though, I think.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And what's... Sorry, no, go on.
No, you go first.
What's great about McCoy's Doctor in this is he's meeting all the individual elements, so and he's putting together the mystery as he goes, as he's running away from cleaners and falling down holes and all this stuff, and he's reading the wall scroll and he's taken from that plot elements. So come the end of episode 3, he's put the whole jigsaw together and he knows he's got to assemble all those factions on Paradise Towers, and that's how they'll defeat Kraglon. It's a really neat script.
Yeah, because I hope I'm not getting confused with the Happiness Patrol, but I know in the Happiness Patrol he sort of says, oh, he's heard things about this place. But isn't that his reason why he doesn't want to leave in the beginning? Because like Mel goes, oh, this place looks horrible. Is there anywhere else with it? And you know, he's wanting to stay because he's heard.
There's now that is a line from the Happiness Patrol.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
But clearly he senses something's up. Because he's just seen that advert for Paradise Towers, which is gleaming towers.
There's a wrong that needs writing, isn't it? Yeah.
So Colin Baker's the one who wrongs rights.
Oh.
No, yes. Hang on. Did I get around that the right way? I think I did.
Oh, I love this bit with the vending machine. Their little faces when they taste the sugary drink for the first time.
I believe, you know, you could buy Fizz-Aid at one point on eBay.
Oh, really?
I think someone had just made a can and just a shitty label and put it on it. Oh, God. See, now look, we've got Brian in a minute going, oh, my beauty, my lovely. What's the matter? I love it because I love a bit of camp, you know. So this is custom built for me.
But also the fact that it's undercut by he fears this. He sees it as his pet, but there's a fear that undercuts everything that his performance in this is really.
Why have you been eating people I've not been sending you to eat? So he says to me,
he's like, he's stammering some of the lines, isn't he? You know, as well, and it is
a performance though. Like, I think people just think he's phoning it in. I don't think so. I think it's deliberate what he's doing.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. The only part I have issue with is when he plays the possessed sort of zombie thing. This for me, I don't understand why people have got a problem with this because it feels, you know, like I say, it feels like he's lifted that character from ever decreasing circles. He has dialed it up a little bit, you know, but then this is, you know, a family fantasy show, not a sitcom, you know.
Do you think his casting was, oh, we got Richard Briers, one of the most popular actors on British television? Or do you think his casting was, this works into how this is a satire on the sort of stuff that he's normally in?
I think at the time it probably was, yeah, we've got Richard Briers.
I think you're probably right as well.
But I think, you know, looking back at, you know, something that was, you know, 30 odd years ago, you can kind of see there may have been like, yeah, he's perfect for this part.
Sort of deconstructing the domestic fantasy. So, oh God, where did that come from? Jesus, I'm trying to be very...
Wow! Thursday evening as well.
What's going on? Too much coffee. You know who's there in those Kangs? I don't know if she's a red or a blue. It's the woman who plays the controller from Bad Wolf and Partner of the Ways.
No way.
You know, really? That beautiful Asian lady, yeah.
Yeah.
The one who goes, oh, shut up, and she's there with her gun. Yeah. She's one of these, and she also plays, someone put it in the comments, Elaine the Pain from BBC, CBBC show. So she got her own show later on as well. But this was JNT cherry-picking the hot young talent that was coming out of drama school at the time. No, sorry, I don't mean that in a rude way. I mean, in terms of sort of performance, yeah. You know, he I think he saw plays and things and thought, we'll give that person a chance.
Yeah. But I think that was, you know, it feels like certainly with this era of Doctor Who that, you know, they were giving young actors a chance, you know, their first go at TV. But they were also with the writers as well, you know, especially when you've got like the previous era, you've got the script editor going, it was hard to find people that could write for Doctor Who. And then Cartmell comes in and basically other than Pip and Jane, everyone's new to Doctor Who that writes a story for this era. And, you know, so it was kind of giving these young, hungry, creative minds a chance to have a go at their trade.
You could tell they were hungry, weren't they? Because they produced these amazingly creative scripts.
Yeah.
Although, Dan, I do have to say one thing to you. You have broken so many rules from this podcast. It would take me several weeks to enumerate them. Wait outside, please, would you?
Okay. Sorry.
Oh, no, here we go. Back to Tabby and Tilda. Oh, this stuff is gold. But, like, how entertaining is this?
Oh, it's very...
like, effortlessly entertaining to watch.
I mean, that's what, you know, like we were saying at the beginning when you were asking me which season is this the worst one, but I prefer stories in 25, but this here, I think from episode one of Time of the Rani right to the end of Dragonfire, it's so easy to watch it. It's just, you know, whereas there are some Doctor Who's that you... that are lauded as being these amazing bits of TV, and I can see that, and they are brilliant, but I don't watch them very often.
Are you talking about Heaven Sent by any chance?
I am talking about that one. I am also talking about Midnight and Turn Left and things like that.
Oh, I love that pair, but, you know, at the end of a long day, I wouldn't stick them on.
No,
I'd exactly. much rather put on Time and the Rani or Delta and the Bannerman.
Yeah, exactly. That's what, you know, this is kind of that, it's got that joyful escapism about it, whereas those are too, ooh.
That is the perfect description. Joyful escapism.
Yeah.
Tagline for the story. But it really is. It's going off somewhere else and having an adventure full of excitement, full of laughs, you know, full of great acting. You lose yourself for four episodes. You're right, I tend not to watch very serious Doctor Who stories lately. Recently, I absolutely crushed The Curse of Fenric in Strictly Come Hamster, which has been released now, so I can say that. And, you know, everyone probably thinks I'm completely mad, but it's so serious. Like, you've got to be in a mood, right? I'm always in the mood for this. I'm occasionally in the mood for The Curse of Fenric.
Yeah, I really love The Curse of Fenric, but yeah, I don't tend to watch it too often. But I think that was because when I got the VHS cassette of it, I played the booger to death. I really did. It was like
Oh,
on.
you're saying you can overwatch things?
Yeah, and now, because I know what's but I mean, the great thing is now with Curse of Fenric, we've had so many different versions of it. It's almost like the Five Doctors and Shada, isn't it? That the director's cut, special editions, the movie version, and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, that VHS tape, I'm surprised I didn't wear it out because it was on at least once a week. Because I just it for me as a teenager, that was brilliant. We've just talked over the
Oh my God. I mean,
really
what do you think about a cliffhanger featuring Bonnie Langford having a knitted shawl thrown over her head and being menaced by two cannibalistic old ladies?
I mean, on paper, it sounds nuts, doesn't it? It
What you
sounds.
mean on paper? On the screen, it's nuts.
But it's got a the yeah the, there's a real darkness to it, and I think it, you know, again, it's like turning something that you would find in everyday life, these doddery old ladies with their knitting, their crochet, and then turning that on their head and having them using their crochet as a net to trap someone and then threaten them with one of their kitchen utensils. It's just brilliant, you know. I
And
mean,
played completely straight as well. That's the only way you can do it to sell it, I think.
oh, for sure.
I mean, they're having a bit of fun in the next episode. It is great as they're flittering about the kitchen, sorting the pot, waiting for Bonnie Langford to go in it. Or oh, I don't know what part of it they're going to cook. I'll leave that to your imagination. But at the end of this, they just look vicious, don't they?
Yeah, it's that. Is it like a? T is what the toasting fork or whatever you're
Toast.
using for the crumpets earlier on? Yeah,
Get a
because
bloody stabber in the gut or something.
it's almost like a mini trident, isn't it?
And it's weird because it is going back towards the sort of things that the show was kind of put on hiatus for, and that's sharp instruments being wielded and cannibalism, you know, and all those things in 22. But the emphasis, I feel, is really different.
Yeah, but you know, I think when you kind of look back on that story of the cancellation, the hiatus, and then this final period of Classic Who, it felt like the BBC were looking for anything that they could cancel Doctor Who for, so they went for the violence. They went for you know, the Mary Whitehouse approach, I suppose. And then, you know, they said, oh, you know, you got a the only sort of constructive criticism that they could throw at it was that basically when it came back, you've got to make it more fun, more you know, family. And then at this point, I mean, I'm sure we've all read the script doctor by Andrew Cartmell, but basically the BBC weren't even watching you know, the rough copies of it. So basically I don't really think that they were kind of looking, you know, that anyone was watching that there were knives and cannibals and things like that in
Although,
this.
interestingly, there's a scene later, isn't there, where a knife is thrown at Pex. I think it's coming up in part three, which was heavily edited from
Right.
where it originally was.
Okay.
That was JNT saying, too
Yeah.
much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I'm not stupid. Let's not give them a reason to cancel us.
Yeah. They've done
Yeah.
that already. Let's, yeah.
Well, look,
Yeah.
I'm going to head back to Twitter now, if I can scroll down the length of my page to find the comments, because
Oh, there
unfortunately,
was a lot. There was
I've
a
done
lot,
a,
wasn't
but I've also done a lot of retweeting today as well. So, please talk amongst yourself. Oh no, wait, I found it. Hang on. Okay, so I'm going to go for a couple this time because we've got a few. Fraser Gregory asks, quarks or crotons?
Oh, quarks, definitely.
It's a foregone conclusion, isn't it?
Yeah.
Could you do, please, an impression of the quarks?
Don't think I could. I haven't watched that one for a long time. I know
Kelsey, the
it's
strike! Shall we destroy?
I don't know if I can reach that high.
I'll kick you in the nuts.
All right, okay.
All of Time and Space podcasts ask very bizarrely, which is best, Exeter or Plymouth? What the hell does that mean?
Well, we're both Devon boys, aren't we, me and Mark? So I would go Exeter. And I know Mark would be pleased about that because that's where he lives.
Is that a critique on the towns?
There's a rivalry between Plymouth and Exeter. There's a big rivalry. I mean,
is it like the Red Kangs and the Blue Kangs?
Yeah, it's definitely like the Red Kangs and the Blue Kangs, except it's red and white and green.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So when there have been, I mean, I don't want to bore you with football, but when
is it football? Oh,
that is part.
Two straight blokes I might have known.
Yeah, so when Plymouth Argyle play Exeter City, that it can get quite tasty afterwards.
Really? Come on, I'm listening now. What do you mean tasty?
There's been quite a few scuffles and fights break out between rival fans.
Oh, sorry, your definition of tasty and mine are two very different things. Okay. Just for a second there, this podcast was vaguely heterosexual, and then I'll spoil it. I'm so sorry. Oh, okay. It was about football teams.
It's beyond football, but it's just because they're the two biggest bits of Devon, and
is the straightest thing I've ever heard. It's beyond football. Well, okay, I'm going to give you another question here then. This is actually about the story. Fraser's in again. Fraser's on form here.
He's on fire, yeah.
Should Paradise Towers have been given one of its episodes to Delta and the Bannermen to make both stories better paced?
I am going to draw a line in the sand here and say no. Because purely from the fact, I love Paradise Towers as I've been talking about it, but Delta and the Bannermen is almost perfect. Oh, and I wouldn't want to spoil, I wouldn't, and part of the perfection of it is that kind of pace of it. So I wouldn't want to add another episode in it to kind of slow it down. I just love that. Because even like you've got, is it the piece of music that he plays quite a lot throughout Kef is a piece of classical music, isn't it? Like, is it like the dance of the Kings? That's the one. And I think that suits the pace of the story as well, you know, sort of thing. So I wouldn't touch Delta and the Bannermen. The question is, would a one less episode help Paradise Towers?
I don't think so. I think this is perfectly structured.
Yeah.
I feel like the various elements are introduced for episode 1 and 2. They're put together in episode 3, which then presents a solution in episode 4. It's almost a pitch perfect 4-part Doctor Who story.
Which is unusual for Cartmel, because normally they're either overrunning or underrunning, aren't they? Well, normally overrunning, but you know, you've almost got like, for later stories, you've almost got a whole new episode to add to it, haven't you?
Though? Well, Curse of Fenrir, there was enough material for 5, wasn't it? And one of my criticisms about that, because obviously we're talking about the transmitted story, is that it just makes no fucking sense when you watch the original version with character scenes and plot points actually edited out of the story.
Sure, yeah.
Well, Daniel Rawnsley has a suggestion for a new television show for the two of us to watch. He's calling it The Fresh Prince of Paradise Towers. A pitch for an alternative universe, brand new weekly Doctor Who sitcom starring the Seventh Doctor, Melanie Bush, and the Chief Caretaker, complete with an opening song. Changed my mind, he says.
I'm probably the last person to ask because I don't like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air.
Neither do I.
The rest of my family in this flat, if you would ask them, they would love that. They'd be all over that because they love old Will Smith and they love the Fresh Prince. But for me, it's not something that kind of, I was aware of it, but I never watched it because it just
No, yeah. I heard that theme tune and I was like, no, I'm out.
Yeah, I'm out. Yeah.
Although on that note, Daniel has provided us with the first line of the Fresh Prince of Paradise Towers. I shan't rap it though, because, you know, I don't want to be as embarrassing as the Ringmaster in Greatest Show in the Galaxy, or even worse, Sophie Aldridge's reading of it in the Target version of Greatest Show. Oh, she does it. She tries rapping it at the start of the audio Target.
Ooh.
I'll send it to you. It's awful. Anyway, he says, in Emswell's house, where born and raised, in the basement where I spend most of my days. That's how it's starting.
Okay.
Okay, one last question then, because we've got a few to get through. How do you think this story would be different if Colin had been kept on for season 24?
Wow.
Would Colin work in this?
It'd be a very different story, wouldn't it? If it was, you know, because, like, I think he works really well in Time and the Rani, but like we say, it's very much a Colin Baker script that's kind of like, we've got nothing else, the cupboard's bare, so we just make this and put Sylve in it.
An assault of colour in Time and the Rani. I figured if Colin was in that, it's the only story where the actual story around him is more colourful than that bloody coat.
Yeah, because I mean, like we say, Colin was very much a kind of up and at 'em kind of character, wasn't he? He was straight in there. He was very confrontational. So I think you would kind of lose like what we were saying with that lovely little piece where Sylvester's kind of doctor has worked out that he can use the rule book to his advantage and against these guys that live by it. And I don't know whether that doesn't feel like Colin's doctor, does it?
No, we just opened the scene with the two of them on the floor in a bloody heap. What happened? The fella beat the shit out of us and ran.
Yeah.
Although it's kind of full of weird grotesques, like doctors and Revelation of the Daleks. And he does do well with it, was sort of over the top theatrical characters.
Yeah.
Maybe. I mean, he's not in it, so we ain't got to worry. But like, as an intellectual exercise, it's quite interesting.
No, I mean, I think season 24, because it is that transition, we're going from Colin to Sylvester, and you know, Cartmel's still trying to find his voice and kind of direct it, you know, in the direction that he wants it to go. But I think you could have Colin Bate if they kind of, you know, things have worked out differently and they said, okay, Colin, we'll give you one more season, then you regenerate at the end,
which is what he asked for.
Yeah, I think if they given him that, I can see him in season 24. Because it isn't quite the McCoy era yet. It isn't quite the, you know, Cartmel's vision. He's still feeling his way into it, and I think you don't properly get that until Remembrance, I don't think.
And the thing is, Colin can be so charming. Like, you listen to his Big Finish performances, he can be gentler than McCoy when he wants to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think he would get on well with the Kangs. I think he would. I don't know if he would have a very good relationship with Peck, though. I think he would find him frustrating and
a bit like Herbert in Time Lash.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. You know, he'd be very short with him, and whereas McCoy is quite understanding and kind of treats him quite, you know, gently. Whereas I think like Colin would be, you know, he'd be a bit more.
Although yeah. I'd love to see that scene in Delta and the Bannermen, you know, where McCoy confronts Scavrock. I'd love to see Colin come along with that white flag, get up the stairs, and then just punch the lights out of him and take the prisoners away. Oh, it probably could work. Yeah, 24 could probably work.
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of those what ifs, because, you know, that was a decision taken out of their hands, and if they had the choice, JNT would have continued with Colin.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh. Well, look, let's steer away from speculation and go and watch episode 3 of Paradise Towers starring Sylvester McCoy, shall we?
Okay.